Hello, listeners, and welcome to a special holiday edition of the Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host, coming to you the day after Thanksgiving with Politico magazine correspondent Tim Alberta. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Scott.
So what we're going to do this week, a little different than usual. The full panel is scattered across the country celebrating Thanksgiving with friends and family. But we wanted to sit down with Tim and dig in a little bit to a recent story, a big story that he did for Politico magazine. And it was a profile of former House Speaker John Boehner, who is in some ways loving life in retirement, looking back at his former colleagues in Congress and everything else in Washington and kind of chuckling to himself a little bit as the world burns. And also tinged with not an insignificant amount of regret, it seems like. And Tim spent a lot of time with the former speaker and came out with this incredible story, Boehner Unchained, which completely accurately describes the multitude of quotes within. But Tim, tell us a little bit about what's going on inside John Boehner's head right now.
I think he is a much more complicated individual than anyone necessarily recognized or gave him credit for during his time on the Hill. This is, after all, the kind of gruff, chain-smoking Midwesterner who would cuss at everybody and was known to be kind of the curmudgeon-in-chief on Capitol Hill, but who would break down in tears at the mere mention of school children or veterans.
Making sure that these kids have a shot at the American dream, like I did.
This is a guy who is liberated now that he is gone from Congress. He can smoke his two packs a day, and he can mow his lawn, and he can be left alone by the outside world. And yes, I think there is certainly some amount of, you know, swirling a glass of Merlot and throwing his head back and cackling at the misfortune that is bedeviling Speaker Paul Ryan and Leader Mitch McConnell and some of the Republican leadership in Congress that has struggled in this first year of the Trump administration to get much done. But I think on the other hand, again, to your point, that while Boehner does feel liberated, I think he also feels burdened. I think he looks back at his 25 years in Washington and feels some sense of incompletion, some sense of insecurity, some sense of failure.
It strikes me from your reporting that, yeah, Boehner is spending a lot of time considering his place in history and the fact that it most likely seems to be as part of the story of a Republican Party and a Congress falling apart.
I think that's right. I think that Boehner had a better view of the Republican Civil War than just about anybody. And it's not lost on him that there were times in that, you know, 8-year post-George W. Bush period of infighting in the GOP that decisions Boehner made contributed in some way not only to the sort of further fracturing of the party itself, but to the ascent of Donald Trump, to the emergence of or the reemergence of perhaps some of the more unseemly or uglier elements of the Republican Party or the conservative base. I think Boehner absolutely looks back at that time, not just at those 8 years, but over the 25 years he was in D.C., going back to 1990, and he left, of course, in 2015. I think he looks at all of it and has to. I think it's a very human instinct to look back on your career and not just wonder, you know, what you might have done differently. I mean, anybody would do that if they gave their life to something. But I think in Boehner's case, specifically wondering what the ramifications have been from things he did, from what the party went through under his stewardship, and specifically if some of the polarization in the country right now, in the Congress, in the Republican Party, could have been avoided had he handled certain things differently. I think that gnaws at him, frankly.
Your story, as all your stories are, is littered with colorful anecdotes. But what can you tell us one that illustrates what you're talking about here in terms of these incidents that have left him thinking?
Well, there are a number of them. I guess, Scotty, I would probably start at the very beginning and say that when I first got to Ohio for my first interview with Boehner, and when we got on the golf course, what was so striking to me is I was not at all prepared to encounter somebody who was quite so regretful, quite so distracted, quite so, I think, visibly and viscerally bothered by some of what they had been grappling with in retirement. I was expecting to encounter somebody who was much more kind of carefree and somebody who had been able to compartmentalize and just kind of move beyond that that stage of his life, those unpleasant memories of being in some sense run out of the Congress.
Fighting
with the Freedom Caucus, government shutdowns. I very much expected to find John Boehner at peace. And I don't want to overstate it and make it sound as though he was in the fetal position and weeping. But it was certainly...
He weeps standing straight up, yes, as we've seen on national TV many times.
Yes. And quite easily. But it, I'll be honest, it was very surprising to me that when we were on the golf course and he was playing very poorly, and I started to ask him, well, what do I make of this? I thought you were a really good golfer. And his explanation was that he's finding it very difficult to concentrate these days, that he was always able to concentrate when he was in Congress and when he was working, but these days he just can't seem to concentrate. And that individual conversation, that relatively brief conversation, seemed to sort of open the floodgates for us to, I think, go a couple of layers deeper and get beyond just the surface level conversations about what his experiences were in Congress and really sort of probe for some of the emotions, I think, that he was feeling that I very honestly did not expect him to be feeling.
One of the key policy areas that you two talked about that seemed to be troubling him was immigration. And in 2013, the Senate passed on a bipartisan basis a pretty sweeping, comprehensive immigration reform bill that never came up for a vote in the House. Tell us a little bit of the backstory there. You were covering Congress at the time. You were covering the House, and you talked to Boehner and people around him again later. And tell us a little bit about what happened there, because that never came to a vote in the House after passing the Senate pretty overwhelmingly.
That's right. And the context, of course, is that after the 2012 election and Mitt Romney had won 27% of Hispanic voters nationally, and the Republican National Committee commissioned its autopsy, in which basically the RNC and much of the Republican Party, broadly speaking, including some of the really conservative members on Capitol Hill, walked away from the 2012 election convinced that they needed to do something on immigration. They needed to address the issue and take it off the table because Democrats were just going to continue to bludgeon them with it. What happened was, and I can still remember being in the middle of this, and it was happening at warp speed, kind of neck-breaking speed. We went from a place, after Senate passage of the Gang of Eight bill, we went from a place of wondering, would there be, 120 Republicans on board with this, to, oh my gosh, will we even get 30 or 40 Republicans on board with this? The backlash from the conservative base, from talk radio, from outside groups, from constituents, dialing the phones off the hook in the Capitol, was so ferocious that I think Boehner and the entire leadership team took a step back to reassess the situation and say, look, if we bring this bill to the House floor, we are taking a real chance that there could be a mutiny here. That, yes, Democrats will vote for it. And if all of the Democrats in the House vote for it, then yeah, probably only we'd need a couple of dozen Republicans to vote for it. And they certainly would have had those numbers. But for Boehner, this is a guy who at that point had already survived a coup on his speakership and who was nervous about the right flank in his party swallowing him up and chewing him up and spitting him out and ending his speakership. And so Boehner ultimately was forced to make a decision. Do I bring this to the floor? It's not a perfect bill, but it's a pretty good bill, and I like a lot of what's in it. Do I bring it to the floor knowing that it would pass with a very small number of Republicans and I might just lose my job because of it? Or do I protect my right flank by not bringing this bill to the floor? But in so doing, I'm punting on an issue that I know in my heart of hearts that we as a party need to address. And ultimately, Boehner chose to protect his right flank. And I absolutely think that that is a decision that continues to haunt him.
And then, of course, he goes on to lose his job anyway.
Yes.
Partly due to pressure from that right flank. Do you get the feeling – I think there's a genre of stories out there practically of former politicians who now liberated from the need to raise money and run for reelection start truth-telling. How much of that do you think is kind of Boehner just trotting this well-worn path, and how much of it do you think is a kind of unique feeling of deep regret?
I think it's a little bit of both at the risk of giving a political answer. I do think it's both because I think on the one hand, Boehner was a guy, I can't tell you how many people have said to me since the story was published, people on the Hill who knew Boehner and interacted with him and who said, boy, I got to say that the Boehner I knew behind closed doors, I didn't think we'd ever see him captured that way in the media, because he was always very careful about, you know, when it was just members and just staffers, then he'd cut loose and he'd say, oh, F this guy, F that guy, and he would let it fly. But he was always very careful to be buttoned up when the cameras were around, when there were reporters with a microphone turned on. So I do think that what we were effectively able to do is capture the real guy here. There is a real authenticity about Boehner that endears him to people, including people who dislike him ideologically and disagree with him ideologically. There are an awful lot of conservatives on the Hill, including some of the people who wanted to run him out of town, who were crying when the guy left as speaker because they really liked him as a human being.
On the flip side, President Obama probably belonged in that group, right, of people who liked him personally more so than they liked him ideologically.
Absolutely. Obama, Biden, you know, we have a line in the piece that says, you know, Boehner on his way out almost felt more embraced by Democrats than he did by Republicans, because at least with Democrats, they always knew where the fault lines were ideologically and on policy matters. But when Boehner called Obama to tell him that he was stepping down, Obama said, Boehner, you can't do this. And then he eventually said, Boehner, I'm going to miss you, man. And one of the most glowing quotes in the entire piece was from Joe Biden, the former Democratic vice president, of course, saying, you know, to get this thing back together, talking about a broken political system, to get this thing back together, we're going to need some more John Boehners. And I think just hearing that language from guys who led the Democratic Party, I don't know that you ever heard anything quite so generous about Boehner from within the Republican Party.
A lot of the piece obviously looks back on Boehner's career and things that happened during it, his reaction to that now, and as well as his reaction to, you know, the first year of the Trump administration and some of the stuff happening in Congress. But you also dug in with him into a few kind of future-focused things about how his party looks heading into midterms, the current speakership of Paul Ryan. What are a couple things that he said that you think we ought to be keeping an eye on in terms of potentially forecasting, you know, future events, things that are going to matter going forward?
I asked him very broadly and openly speaking, you know, what he thinks historians were going to make of his speakership. And his answer was, I think they'll be talking about the end of the two-party system, which, look, in a piece full of F-bombs and funny, colorful anecdotes, maybe something like that you just read and you think, huh, and then you kind of go to the next line. But I just continue to this day to be so struck by the fact that the recently departed Speaker of the House of Representatives is saying that he believes that the two-party system has effectively come to an end. And I don't think it was hyperbole. I don't think he was saying it to make a point. I think he's totally sincere. And I also happen to think that Paul Ryan, the current speaker, views it the exact same way. Paul Ryan had a line in the piece I also thought was very striking, saying that we effectively run a coalition government without the efficiency of a parliamentary system, which is another kind of a breathtaking thing to hear the current speaker acknowledge. And they're both making the same point, albeit in different ways. They're both essentially acknowledging that the Republican Party, as we've known it, is fractured in a way that limits its capacity to govern.
As we've seen over the last 11 months.
Exactly. He, at one point, began to say, there is no Republican Party. And he sort of stopped himself. And we had this very interesting exchange. And he said, well, look, there is, but what does it even mean? President Trump, he said, and this is not verbatim, but it's pretty close. He said, you know, President Trump isn't a Republican. He's not a Democrat. He's a populist. He doesn't have an ideological bone in his body. If the president and the leader of the party is not really a member of the party, then what does that mean? What does it mean for the executive branch? What does it mean for the legislative process? All of that said, I think Boehner also looks at that and ties it into something even more broad, which is the bitter polarization that we see in the country, and that it's part of kind of a self-perpetuating cycle where people are receiving their news from self-selecting echo chambers, whether it's social media or cable news or whatever, and then they are going to the polls and electing people who are going farther left or farther right, refusing to engage in any idea of compromise, any semblance of compromise. And then those people in Congress are incentivized only to vote in a way that gets them reelected by the respective party bases. And Boehner said to me, you know, by the time I was meeting with President Obama a little while into my speakership, they had to sneak me in and out of the White House because both Obama and I agreed on the fact that it wasn't good for us, for our party bases, to see us interacting with each other. That's a pretty striking thing. And Biden shared similar anecdotes. Biden said, you know, do you think it's a coincidence that Boehner only played golf with us once? He played golf with us once and he got hammered for it.
For all the talk about people wanting bipartisanship, there's a louder, certainly louder, potentially larger group of people who don't want to see. I remember hearing about a focus group in 2015 as Republicans were starting to come to grips with the idea that Trump was extremely popular within their party and maybe on his way to a primary victory, about how a focus group participant said, you know, we need people in Congress to work together more. And two people jumped in after that and said, are you crazy? That's my worst nightmare. We don't want these people. These are all crooks. We don't want them working together. And, you know, I think that explains a lot of where we are right now.
Without question. And in fact, the current majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, had said something to me that I don't think wound up making its way into the story. It was on the cutting room floor ultimately. But he said, we were talking about this very thing, and he said, you know, the American people say they want a lot of things, but they don't actually want those things. And I think that's true. I think that if you are John Boehner, sort of an old school throwback politician who came from an era, at least, you know, emerged from an era where deal making was in vogue and where, you know, the smoke-filled back room wasn't a pejorative. I mean, that was where you went to get things done. Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan would go out and have some whiskeys and they would find a way to work these things out. Well, that era is gone, and I don't think it's ever coming back, not with, you know, Fox News and MSNBC and Twitter and people in the grassroots in both party bases being exposed to a constant deluge of information, some of it accurate, some of it not, that is sort of driving them further into their own pre-existing positions. It makes it very difficult for people on Capitol Hill to have any room to maneuver.
Tim, I want to close up. Just take us inside the process of reporting this story. How do you manage to write such a big, long, sweeping story about something? You know, what's the process of just getting to go golfing with John Boehner and then organizing your thoughts afterwards?
Boy, that's a good question, and I'll try not to ramble on because it's a long answer. But I think what was fun about this is I had heard that Boehner was having real doubts about writing a book, as many prominent politicians will do after office. They get offered a big advance. They go to write a memoir. Boehner wasn't sure he wanted to do that. And when I heard that, I thought, well, maybe here's my chance. I'd really wanted to do a big piece on Boehner ever since he left. And I was not at all optimistic that he would agree to it. And in fact, I finally got word back that he wanted to have dinner with me and talk about the piece. And so I thought, oh, great. And when we were at that dinner, it was Boehner and myself and one of his longtime former staff members, former spokesperson, Michael Steele. And Michael Steele had warned me beforehand. He said, look, you know, odds are, even if Boehner agrees to something, it's probably going to be maybe 45 minutes on the record tonight at dinner. So I hope you bring your notepad with you and we'll just, you know, probably bang this thing out right here. And I didn't want to do that. If we were going to do this right, I really wanted to have the chance for an extended, deep dialogue with the speaker.
Get a sense of his state of mind.
Yeah,
I mean, in a short conversation.
And you can't do that, frankly, you can't do that over a quick dinner. You can't always really do that with another person present. And I wasn't sure. I mean, I'm really asking for a lot at that point, right? So the long story short is that when I talked that part of it through with Boehner, he said, "Yeah, that's great. That sounds pretty good. I'd like somebody to actually take a, you know, an unhurried look at this." And I said, "Well, I'd like to get you in your natural element. Could we maybe play some golf sometime?" You're just kind of putting it out there. And he said, Yeah, you want to come to Ohio? I've got a tournament coming up. And I said, you mean it? And he said, oh, yeah. I'll put you up. Come to my, you know, you can stay at my place. No, I did not stay at his place. I think he might have been very sincere with the offer. But the funny thing, Scott, is that once Boehner agreed to that, you know, first interview and then to subsequent interviews and we started planning this, Michael Steele, like a good staffer does, started to talk about, okay, well, let me arrange these logistics and let me do this, that, and the other thing, and we'll get this really lined up and buttoned away. And Boehner cast this very disapproving look in his direction and said, you effing guys, like, you don't get it, do you? You're still trying to manage me. I don't want to be managed anymore. And he looked at me and he said, Junior, I'll give you my cell phone number. We'll figure this out. And we did. And all of our dialogue, Boehner and I, over the next 3.5 to 4 months, there was never anybody babysitting us. There were no staffers hanging around listening in on the conversations. it truly was John Boehner unchained in that sense. You could see in his face when we were out on the golf course or when we were on his patio and we're having wine in his living room, you could see the relief that when he dropped an F-bomb, he didn't have anybody giving him a dirty look, other than at times his wife.
Right, I was about to say, yeah. Well, listen, Tim, thank you so much for walking us through this. I urge everyone to read the piece, John Boehner Unchained, on Politico Magazine online. Tim, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
And thank you all, as usual, for tuning in. Remember, if you have questions for us to mull over on a future Nerdcast, you can email us at nerdcast@politico.com. And remember to subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. So once again, thank you to Tim Alberta for being here. Thank you to Matt Sobosinski, our producer on this episode, Bridget Mulcahy, our executive producer, and Bill Cookman, the Nerdcast illustrator. Thanks again for listening. We will talk to you again next week.